Hi, Eric.
Hey Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm excited.
Okay.
Part two of our multi-part series.
Yes.
Will there be a part
Part two
three?
of two? Oh, well, that's what I was just asking. My guess is no,
We'll
but
see.
I don't know. But there, it wasn't originally planned to be two parts, so.
I want to start with the concept of credit.
Credit like at the end of a movie?
Nope. Well, I
Oh.
guess so. I actually like the like it at the end of a movie.
Not like from a bank.
Not from a bank. I
Okay.
want to talk about personal credit.
Okay. I'm listening.
The
Have
reason
you
I
not
thought
been
I'd
getting enough praise, Aaron,
no, that's
for your
well,
labor?
okay. Well, this is why I wanted to start here. As you know, I am a scientist.
Yes.
We've mentioned this on behalf to the point where it's becoming cliche, I'm afraid. Perhaps it would be better to say, for the purposes of this discussion, that I'm an academic,
Sure.
and what I trade on is credit. And so I kind of wanted to talk first about what that means before we dive into a discussion of priesthood and authority and ordination and stuff.
Okay.
So when I write a paper, okay, there's two things that are super important. Who's on it, right? And
Meaning the
the
writers, the authors.
authors, yep, the authors, and the order that they're listed in.
Yes.
There's actually a third secret thing that's really important that you only learn about once you start running your own group, right? Which is the funding acknowledgement at the bottom of the paper. You have to cite what grant paid for the work. And that way, when you go and write a new grant, you can say, hey, look at all the great stuff that I did with my last grant.
Oh, so it's not so that cynical people can say, well, Philip Morris paid you, and that's why you reported
Yes.
that cigarettes are good for us. That's not
Yes.
the
I
reason.
feel like I should cut you off. I have never been supported by Philip Morris.
Sorry, I didn't mean you specifically, you generically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some scientists at some time.
My funding comes from the Department of Energy and the National Institute of Health. So that's important. But the credit at the top of the paper is super important. And I've screwed it up in the past. There have been situations where I left an author off on accident who was actually part of the original experiment, right? And or we've had to t negotiate the order of authors. We've had to share credit. Like we've
It's
done a
actually
lot of.
just like movie credits.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We have
Yeah.
to do co-first authors a lot of the time. And for the experiments that are in, there's sometimes like 50 authors on these papers, right?
Yeah, a
It's
lot of
funny.
people involved.
The first and the second and the third and the fourth author kind of really matter, as does the last, next to last, third from last. Then once you start hitting into the middle of 50 authors, it doesn't really matter very much. Okay, so it's not just authorship of papers that I trade on, right? But it's invitations to conferences, it's public speaking events, right? It's serving on boards for like various professional things, right? And all of this really, 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 really matters. Like I cannot overstate how much it matters. If I get credit wrong, right, it can greatly hurt my career and those around me. And so when we have a discussion about authority in the church, I want to say it's very possible that that viewpoint is tinting my perspective on it.
Your viewpoint of authority is tinting your perspective on the order of authors.
Well, let me, maybe it was the other way around. What I mean is
Your
that,
thoughts about the order of authors is tinting your thoughts about church authority.
yeah, you got it.
How so?
When you walk into a sacrament meeting and you see who's up on the stand, right? You see dudes, especially now in the Bay Area, right? And even though we're not supposed to care about credit, I think that enough people do that it's a problem.
Yes, I think so. I don't want to interrupt you, so, but I came up with a new metaphor recently. It really bugs me this idea that some callings are higher or lower. This is on my mind
Okay.
because our stake presidency was just reorganized this past Sunday.
Yeah.
And so I don't like that. I just don't think that Jesus thinks the nursery leader is lower than the stake president. I don't
Right.
think that's true. But it's really natural for us to say up or down when we talk about callings, like moving up, moving down, et cetera. And it's semi-jokey, but the thing is, semi-jokey things are still real.
Yeah.
That's why, like, racist or sexist or homophobic jokes or whatever are bad, because even if you don't mean it, if you say something often enough, it starts to feel real.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was thinking about this and I came up with a new metaphor. You'll be the second person I've shared this with, I think. So tell me what you think about this. Instead of up and down, what about in and out? So our primary teacher has four kids in her class, let's say. And so she's moved into the church and she gets to focus on this small number of individuals and serve them in a really direct and personal way. And the stake present is quite a ways out, right? He's in charge of a few thousand people, a small number of thousands of people, and he's moved out. And so he has much more people to care for, but his ability to do that one-on-one stewardship for all of them is greatly diminished. And anyway, in and out instead of up and down, initial reaction.
I think it's good. It does, however, put in my mind the phrase, the room where it happened, right?
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's what I'm trying to get at. And I'm not convinced I've made my point the way I wanted to make it, right? I am, I hope, capable of separating my academic interests and the game that I have to play there, right, from my attitudes towards church and its callings. And I want to try and make that a bit more clear. When we're called to serve in the church, we are literally called to serve. As part of preparation for today, I read the Fiona Givens article that you linked to last time, right? And it was very, very awesome. And it's called A Society Meet for Male Priesthood, right? And in it, Fiona,
in this case, meaning equal to, I believe that would be the definition we're working from.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in it, she, of course, cites DNC 21, right? DNC 121. It is in the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little power, as they suppose, that they immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. In other words, what she says here, quoting, almost all fail the test, right? All too often, priesthood is equated with influence, control, status, power, or visibility. And people seek priesthood for the power it gives them to administer rather than to minister. Right?
Yeah.
What she's arguing is that foundational to the organization of the church, the way that Jesus organized it, is, I think she even uses the word anathema. Power.
That's fun.
Yeah. Power is anathema. Oh, sorry. Unrighteous dominion is anathema to priesthood. Right?
Yes. But it follows along really closely with having control over other people. It's really hard to separate those things.
Okay. So with that said, I could then make the argument that if we're supposed to essentially be, as you say, in or out, right? Meaning that it's not we're supposed to be dealing with a non-hierarchical mode.
Yeah.
Right? How can we reconcile that with the feeling of injustice as it relates to women and the priesthood?
I suspect that reconciling it is a mistake. I think that this is something that, as long as we are mortal and dealing with fellow mortals, we should always be concerned about. I'm not sure that reaching satisfaction is in anyone's best interest.
You know, this article was written in, I think, 2014. Right at the start of the article, she says, there appear to at least be three principal positions with regard to women and male priesthood. Most Latter-day Saint women support the status quo. The latest Pew study, that's P-E-W, finds little support for the notion that women should be eligible for the Mormon priesthood. Only 1 in 10 Mormons, 11%, believe that women should be ordained to the priesthood of their church, whereas 87% think the priesthood should be open only to males. Large majorities of both men and women express this view. Surprisingly, perhaps, women are somewhat more likely than men to say that priesthood should be only open to males, a 90% versus 84%, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was very surprised by this study.
I also really wonder if it's still true 10 years later.
Ah, see, now you're...
I suspect this is pretty dynamic.
Now you're talking. Because, I went ahead and I started, as part of my research for today, started reading more, like we said before, on the Equal Rights Amendment, right? The Ordain Movement, Ordain Women Movement, and so forth, right? And on the Wikipedia article, it quotes the same study on the Wikipedia article for Ordain Women, right? Essentially giving the same numbers. Quote from the Wikipedia article. While these results have been widely studied, the survey itself has been described as problematic by some. The relevancy of the results have been questioned based on the fact that the survey question, should women who are dedicated members of the LDS Church be ordained to the priesthood, is an either-or proposition, whereas a spectrum of views on female ordination exists within the LDS faith. Additionally, it has been suggested that these results are quickly becoming outdated as a result of the increased discussion of female ordination.
I think even as recently as 2014, a significant percentage of people in the church had never really thought about it, which sounds crazy, but I genuinely believe that at least deep thought hadn't really occurred for most people. And it's, I think that the thought is getting deeper.
Yeah. Well, last time we talked about how women weren't allowed to give the prayer in general conference until 2013.
Yeah.
Right. So it wouldn't surprise me if you're right. Okay. But I want to make the distinction between the Ordain Women movement, right, which is all about priesthood ordination and leadership. I think it's very clear that women have priesthood power. If you read any of the doctrines from modern church leaders, it makes that clear. So, for example, this is a quote again from Fiona Givens' article, and she's quoting Elder Ballard. When men and women go to the temple, they are both endowed with the same power, which by definition is priesthood power, right? So to me, whether or not you ordain women is an interesting question, but isn't the one that I want to talk about, at least at the moment. Maybe we can talk about it later. It's leadership. It's management, right? And it's tangentially related to this concept of credit, right? But more, it's related to the concept of voice, right?
Representation.
About representation.
Just anecdotally.
Yeah.
After women were kicked off the stand, it didn't mean that women no longer attended meetings that are not public. So, for instance, there are a lot of wards that invite the Relief Society Young Women in Primary Presence to bishopric meetings. But if you're not on the stand, most members of the ward just simply will not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it looks like a male dominated leadership, right?
Which, I mean, it still is, but yeah.
I mean,
more than less, it might actually be.
It's less so at the ward level, I think.
It can be.
Yeah. I mean, it's still imbalanced. If you counted men versus women in bishopric meeting, right? For a fully staffed ward council, let's say that. A fully staffed ward council, right, where all the members of all the presidencies attend, and you just added up men versus women for a full ward staff, because you're going to add the executive secretary, the ward clerk, the Sunday school president, and his two counselors, right?
Yes, it outpaces.
What do you think the ratio would be? 60-40? 75-25?
This is also something that varies a lot by ward. So, for instance, in our ward, we have a number of committees. Some of them are not unusual, like the missionary committee and the temple / family history committee. But we invite the chairs of the committees to ward council. Usually they swap off. Usually there's the co-chairs are ones from Relief Society, ones from Elders Quorum, and they usually alternate their attendance. But so the more committees you have, as long as they're equally balanced in your imaginary meeting, we get closer and closer to equity. The more committees there are, but we'll never quite reach it. We'll never quite make it all the way because of the five people in the bishopric. The bishop is two counselors, and then the secretary and the clerk and any assistants they have.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, you're absolutely right.
And obviously, a meeting can get too large.
Too large. Of course, once you hit the stake level, it becomes laughable.
Mm-hmm.
You have 12 high council members, the stake presidency and the clerks, right? The elders quorum mm-hmm. presidency. And on the women's side, you have three presidencies.
They can have committees. That's not unusual. But and the same thing with the young women and the primary. They can have like sort of an equivalent to the High Council, but I've never heard of those people being invited to stake level meetings with the all the stake president and all the High Council. That sort of like I've just never heard of a meeting like that. But I've never served at the stake level, so what do I know? That's not
And
true. I
then
was
if
a seminary teacher, so you too have served at the stake level.
oh, well, how
That
about
that's a stake calling, yeah.
that? And then also, of course, there's no women bishops,
Sure.
or I'm going to state it differently. There's no presiding women over a congregation, right?
Yeah.
And that's the real question about equity, right? To me it is. Maybe that's just me, but to me that's kind of the crux of it. Because it's like what our theme was from the last time we did this, right? There's separable concepts. There's ordination to the priesthood, right? There's priesthood power itself, and there's leadership. Fiona, of course, argues that Joseph Smith set it up for them to be absolutely equal. The relationship
That is,
between the Elders' Quorum and the Relief Society, or rather to the priesthood and the Relief Society, the male priesthood and the female Relief Society,
yeah,
to be
that's the way
absolutely
I
equal.
understand her argument.
Okay, so let's talk about the room where it happened. Okay.
The room where what happened?
The room where it happened. Have you watched Hamilton before?
No, but I have listened to it. I know this. I know the song. I know the story.
Okay. For those that don't, it's a fabulous song, right? And it describes a meeting between three powerful men from the 1700s. To see if I get my history right. As they've set up parts of the United States government, right? And Aaron Burr, who was not in the meeting, was just like, I want to be in the room where it happened. In other words, something important happened there, and I was excluded. Okay, so having said that, what happens in a ward, okay, at that level, at that kind of.
Yeah, so if I understand your question correctly, you're asking. The answer to your question would be things like who receives what calling, would be an example of what's happening at the ward level. And while the church has strongly encouraged the use of larger councils, like the entire ward council, for instance, to make these decisions, it is well known that in many wards, final decisions are still just happening with the bishop, his two counselors, the executive secretary, and the ward clerk. So it depends ward to ward. There can be great variation.
But this is the whole conflict that I'm trying to get at, right? Nobody wants to be a bishop. Nobody. It's the worst. It's so much work. That you have to give up so many Sundays. You have to be there, two or three times a week during at the church. I mean, how many hours a week is do you think being a bishop, like in terms of like part-time employment?
Oh yeah, it would certainly count as at least a part-time job, certainly.
Yeah. Nobody wants it, right? This is why I'm having such a hard time expressing my point, right? I'm having such a hard time bridging the gap of credit to priesthood. And it's possible that it can't be bridged, right? And it may be that this is why the numbers are so high in that Pew study.
Yes. In fact, I have heard that from I haven't heard it in a while, but certainly around the time of these, 2014 that we're talking about, I've certainly heard women say that they would not want the priesthood because they would not want those specific tasks to be assigned to them. But
How do you
I don't
feel
know.
about that statement?
I mean, I don't really want those grapes. They look kind of sour,
Yeah.
you know? I'm not saying that's true of everyone who makes that statement, but I think that there's no point in desiring something you can't have. What that's how is that good for your mental health?
This is why this is such a hard topic. Because the nature of the conversation is that women are denied power in the church. That's the nature of the conversation. But the scriptures explicitly teach that power is not a component of priesthood authority in terms of like dominion over other people.
What do you think the numbers would be if Pew asked about that in their next survey, if they agree with what you just said?
What do you think? Do you agree with what I said?
I think most people in the church would say that's a both and rather than two separate categories. I think you're in a minority here in terms of interpretation.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm trying to say that that's what I necessarily believe, right? I'm trying
Sure,
to
you're just
work through
saying
the
that,
arguments.
yeah, we're being Socratic here.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. What do I personally believe? Okay, we deliberately avoid making value statements last time but I think maybe it's time that I made one, right?
Okay, let's hear it.
The first thing I should say is I don't know what the right solution is, right? But my second answer is that my experience is that a lot of women that I know feel oppressed by the church organization, and that they don't have a voice in how the church is governed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with those statements?
I would agree with those statements.
Okay. Now, how I would change that, would I just say give the priesthood to all women? Would I say give a priesthood to all women, not necessarily the Melchizedek one, but some new fun priesthood, you know, based on some
a separate
passage?
But equal priesthood?
Yeah, a separate but equal priesthood. Let's just ignore trans discussions for a minute. But you see, but of course we can't, and that's a whole problem with this conversation too. Or do we just bite the bullet and say, you know, women can be bishops now, and why don't they get the priesthood? Well, they just don't. It doesn't really matter.
It's pretty difficult, but it's not impossible. Right? I read this in the summer 2023 edition of Wayfair magazine, which is a Latter-day Saint themed magazine. The particular article I was reading was by Nathan Oman, who we've mentioned before on the show, who I don't believe knows my name, but was the AP when I showed up in the Korea Pusan mission. The article is titled "Buying Jewish Whiskey." So tell me if you've heard this one before, Aaron.
Okay.
During Passover, observant Jews are not allowed to have leaven in their households. And as things have been evolve over time, it gets to the point where like people would burn it and then legally say the ashes don't belong to them anymore in case any were left in the room, and you know, to try to follow this rule. But something that has occurred now over time, and this was originally invented by I want to say it was medieval Jewish brewers who were brewing the alcohol. Anyway, what they would do is they would sell their brewery and all their stores to a Gentile for the length of Passover, and then the Gentile would sell it back to them.
I see.
And so they don't own it over that time. It's not theirs.
Yeah.
And so they're in compliance, and then they get it back at the end. That's the solution. So what Nate did is he agreed to do this for a congregation, and he legally purchased basically everyone's pantries in the entire congregation and had legal ownership over all the pantries of everybody at the synagogue. And at the end of Passover, he sold it back to them. Brother Oman is a law professor, and he's interested in religion and the intersection of like contracts and law and religion. Like this is his sweet spot. This is exactly something he would love to do. So that's what the article is about. Anyway, the reason I brought it up is because it suggests that there are some things that Protestants and Latter-day Saints can learn from the Jewish way of dealing with scripture that doesn't change in a changing world. How do you deal with this stuff? So Christians, by which I mean Protestants specifically, Latter-day Saints and the Jews have a number of ways in which they can deal with this problem of scripture remaining static while the world changes around us. The great 19th century jurist and historian Henry Sumner Maine claimed that legal systems change in one of three ways: by legislation, by equity, and by fiction. So legislation is an idea familiar to laypersons, but equity and fiction in the legal context have specific meanings. So legislation obviously is we pass along the law changes, right?
So that'd equity, be like the an official proclamation.
Right, an official proclamation doing away with the priesthood restriction, for instance, would be legislation. That's that kind of change. Equity refers to a loose interpretation of a rule in order to achieve a substantial justice. This, he argues, is what Protestants like to do.
And this was very similar to what we were doing with women in the stand.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's a great comparison. And then fiction refers to the process of adapting legal rules by agreeing to pretend that their conditions have been met when in fact they have not. Then I want to skip ahead real quick. Then he talks more about equity and okay, here we go. Mm-hmm. So, well, I'll just explain it. The whole selling of the pantries to Nathan Oman is nobody really believes that, right? It's a polite fiction that we're all choosing to believe. It's not clear it would stand up in a secular court of law if it came to that. If Nate decided not to sell it back and to own everybody's pantries in perpetuity, he probably couldn't get away with that legally. And so in some sense, the fiction method is exactly that. It's something we're pretending to believe. But he goes on to point out that in a way, it's really good religion, right? This whole process of finding the Gentile who will buy your stuff and sell it back to you is weird and it's strange and it doesn't really make sense. But that turns it into a ritual, because rituals are all things that you don't do in your everyday experience. They're strange and they're weird, and they remind you that you're doing something for religious reasons. So there's a certain advantage to fiction. Fiction manages the problems of fidelity and evolution, allowing the tradition to change without negating itself. Now, he goes on to, he said earlier that while Protestants are fond of equity, and that's how they tend to change things, the problem with that is it results in the drift to spiritual but not religious, and that our tradition has a similar danger of self-negation, but that's through, because we're big into legislation, right? We like official proclamations and new
we love legislation.
Revelations. Yeah, that's how we do it. We have people who can talk to God, so we can have legislation. That is not something Protestants and Jews share with us. So the problem with legislation is if one risks the paradox of an eternal God whose demands can change, which is what legislation essentially suggests, this revelation suggests that things have changed. That could result in expansive authority, which could risk abuse. It suggests that God changes, which is problematic. However, other things like religious accommodation and even religious evolution are a lot easier with legislation. Anyway, the article goes on to suggest that the Protestants and Latter-day Saints both should consider the possibilities of using the fiction method rather than equity and legislation, because although it's the sort of thing that, you know, when you think about things that religious Jews get mocked for, it's largely these fictions, but there's a lot of advantages to them in that they keep us focused on how do we live the law of God. Anyway, that's obviously a gross oversimplification. Legislation, equity, fiction, they have specific meanings in law, but I thought it was really interesting. And I guess to bring it back to what you were saying, what do we need? Like, I think, as you said, we had an equity thing, or a bit of one, right? And I think a lot of equity is happening at the ward levels, in many wards, not all wards, certainly. But as we all hope for legislation, I don't know what a fiction would look like in this case. But if, you know, we called, if Salt Lake allowed the calling of bishops as women bishops and without changing legislation, we would find a way to, you know, we would find a way to do it.
Well,
but it's
no.
Really anathema, speaking of that word,
okay,
to the way we think about religion and scripture and authority and priesthood and all those things. I think we really require legislation for massive changes. Equity can fill in some of the gaps, but if change is a thing that needs to happen, hypothesis, then I think the conclusion has to be that it would be legislative in nature.
Okay, but there is a big barrier. Yes.
Just
yes,
one.
I agree with you. Well, okay, no, the office, the fact that bishop is a priesthood office, right?
Yes, it is.
So here's what I mean. When you're ordained to the priesthood, to the male priesthood of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, right? You're given the Aaronic priesthood, and you're ordained to the office of deacon, teacher, or priest, right? And then you are ordained to the other priesthood called the Melchizedek priesthood, and you become an elder. And that's where you're going to stay for most of your life, is an elder. I am a seminary teacher. I'm still an elder, right? You know, you're an elders quorum president. You're still an elder, right? If you're called to be a bishop, you're ordained to a new office, mm-hmm. bishop, and it's distinct. And you never cease being a bishop, even after you're released.
Well, I mean, I'm still a high priest, even though I'm an elder, functioning as an elder. And the same thing in the 70s, when they got rid of stake level 70s, they were all still 70s. And if you find someone that old in the church website, it will say that they're a 70, but they're also an elder.
Did you have to be high priest to be elders quorum president?
No, I had to be a high priest to be in the bishopric.
Ah, of course. Okay, but that's my point. That feels like if there was ever going to be a woman in charge of an LDS congregation the same way that a bishop is, that I don't see a fiction
scripturally
get, that gets us there.
No, I don't think so either. I think canonically, scripturally, that's unovercomable without revelation. I just don't think so.
But I want to go back to your if statement, okay? I do a lot of argument based on feeling, okay, in religious conversation. And I just want to talk more about mercy and justice really quick. The nature of the atonement of Christ, of course, is mercy and justice. You can't have both, and yet we can because of the Savior. Because of the atonement, we have mercy and justice at the same time. Part of that argument includes this understanding that people have a sense of justice, right? That people know when something wrong happened around them or to them, right? And one of the whole points of the whole judgment story is that we'll be brought before, the bar of God. And, Jesus will say, not for his sake, but for mine. And everybody will say, justice was served. So people know, people understand. It's like when we say in the church that everybody has a conscience, right? People have a sense of justice. Now, that sense is different from culture to culture, I believe, right?
Probably,
Yeah, but it's there. And this is kind of where I think the whole ordain women movement came from, right? Is that when you look at the church organization and you see a paper with 100 men on it and 6 to 9 women on it, right? Then does that feel just? Does it feel equitable, right? And it's a feeling. You have to look at it inside you and say, does this feel like the church's statements about the equality of genders are being fulfilled here, right? Now, again, I'm going to restate the thing that I always state, right? Which is that I'm a true believer, right? That I believe in priesthood power, right? That I'm not rabble-rousing. I'm really just trying to have a conversation about this and work through philosophy and work through religion and feelings, right? I'm not advocating for change today. Two episodes ago in the Taking a Stand episode, right? We did advocate for change. Here I'm not.
And I want to revisit some of those points in a minute.
No worries. But like I said, today I'm not advocating for change because I don't know what the right change would be, right? And I'm still trying to explore the philosophy and the religion around it. Okay.
So I was going to talk about an anarchist. His name is David Graeber, and he wrote a book called The Utopia of Rules, which came out a few years ago. It's great. It will make you think about things in a new way. But the specific thing I want to talk about is he talks about how in any sort of hierarchical society, and societies tend towards hierarchy, the people who are higher in the hierarchy know less about the people below them than the other way around. This is why, for instance, in a society like ours, which struggles with white supremacy, white people don't need to know that much about, say, black people's lives. We don't need to know. We're fine not knowing that. But in order to navigate our society, black people have to know a lot about white people's roles. In a society like ours that struggles with sexism, men don't necessarily need to know a whole lot about the way women feel about things. And whereas women really need to know why men behave the way they do, because it's the only way they can get what they need from their boss and have and you know be treated right economically.
Man, I hate this.
Gay people have to know how straight people behave and act about things and talk about things and feel about things. It's pretty easy to be straight and just not care what gay people think. You can pretend it doesn't matter. This is why, say, being colorblind is such an attractive idea to many white Americans, because it suggests that I don't know about you and it's fine. So you don't have to know about me either. I mean, that's not what they think they're saying, but that's how it's heard by people who've had to spend their whole lives getting to know this other culture that they live with that dominates. And so when you're talking about 100 men and 9 women on the tear out sheet from the Liahona, there's a certain percentage of men in the church who don't have to think about what that might look like because it doesn't really affect them, right? It's a problem for women. And every woman looks at that and definitely notices the disparity. How they feel about it will vary a great deal. Some of them I genuinely believe it doesn't bother them. But men have the option to not even think about it. And if you have a comment, make it, and then I want to tell a story.
Well, I was just going to say, everything you said made me sad.
But it also makes sense, right? And it reflects the world that we live in.
It also is very much the Barbie movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Go back to episode one of this season. So now I want to tell a story from state conference. I want to start off by saying that I mentioned that our state presidency was reorganized. So we had a couple 70s here, including Elder Bragg, who is someone I really admire. He's come to a bunch of our state conferences. Three maybe now, I'm not sure. Anyway,
he was so happy and friendly, I noticed.
Yeah,
in the congregation.
He's such a good guy. I really like him. I've been in a lot of meetings with him. I think I've been in leadership for most of the times he's been here, so that's like at least one extra meeting that I get to spend with him. I find him really open and approachable and intelligent and emotionally resonant and available. Really like the guy. I love him a lot. And he took on the stake ahead of time, sent out a Google form which members could ask questions. And I know a lot of other people asked about the women on the stand thing. And he, in the adult meeting Saturday night, he was courageous enough to stand up and address this. And I loved everything he said all weekend long, except for his answer to this question. And I want to talk about why I didn't love it. I think it probably satisfied maybe a majority of people. But I had a couple issues with it, and there are things that we've already talked about, so I'm not saying anything new, but I think it's really helpful to hear what he had to say about it as an authority figure. So first he talked about the handbag, excuse me, not the handbag. First he talked about the handbook, and now that it's online, he pointed out that it can change frequently to meet the needs of the ward. It's a living document. Feedback from church members is constantly being cycled through stakes to areas, to the 12, to the first presidency, and approvals are happening fairly regularly. That's the first thing he said. I'm not sure why he said that, because I double-checked on Monday, or maybe it was Sunday. I double-checked after this meeting, though, and stuff about women being on the stand is still not in the handbook. So not sure why the handbook came up. Then he said he'd been traveling around a lot and seeing lots of people on the stand. Now, for a later question in the meeting, he mentioned that because of his role as our area president, every Sunday he's at a state conference. He never gets to go to a regular sacrament meeting. And because of this, the members of the 12 and the 70 who are at that level, they have a special meeting in the Salt Lake Temple every, I think it's Thursday, where they have a sacrament meeting together. Currently with the Salt Lake Temple under renovations, there's a dedicated floor on the Joseph Smith Memorial Building where they do this. So he's speaking about state conferences. He's not going to sacrament meetings, which is what we were talking about. He did point out that one state conference had 70 people on the stand, which he saw as silly. And frankly, I agree with him. But on the other hand, if that's our measure of silliness, then General Conference is the silliest meeting of the church. So I'm not sure about that either. So anyway, he felt that to keep from distracting from the actual purpose of sacrament meeting, which is, of course, ordinances, fewer people on the stand would help. I didn't understand the logic of that. I don't know how people on the stand do or do not distract from the meeting. We know from our ward's experience that it can be distracting not to have people on the meeting. Our previous bishopric experimented with having no one on the stand during the sacrament, and it caused chaos because the deacons could not cope with this innovation. And also, as we've talked about, there's a lot of value to being on the stand and having people being able to see the faces of the members of the ward and see who's new. There's a lot of value to being on the stand. So I didn't understand the logic of that. But I can understand why someone might feel that way. He also mentioned, and he really emphasized this a lot, that policies and practices can change. He mentioned that so many times in his answer to this question. And part of me thinks that he's encouraging us to write our state president so he can send it onward and upward, and maybe the handbook will change on this. He was very careful never to say that. But he emphasized how often that things can change, and things change because members reach out. That it's made me wonder. But he said that he decided as the area president that the only people on stand during sacrament meetings should be the presiding authorities and those directly participating in the meeting. And he said he just didn't anticipate the pain this would cause. He wasn't thinking about these issues we're talking about of like equity and optics and visibility and what people assume based on what they see. He didn't anticipate the pain that the removal of women would cause. And he feels terrible. And like I said, I believe Elder Bragg. Like, I don't believe he's manipulating this. I really believe that he is who he seems to be. and that he is was emotionally troubled by this. And he came close. It felt like it seemed like he came close a lot of times to straight up apologizing, but he always paused before that moment and never quite arrived there. So maybe I'm misreading. Maybe I'm just seeing what I wish I could see. And then the last thing he said in his answer to the question was, in his core, he's all about loving and serving and supporting the 12 apostles and the first presidency, and he cannot go against them. Which raised questions too. So I'm a little confused. Is it in an official policy? And if so, why is it not in the handbook? Is this his Elder Bragg's personal feelings about propriety? Is that kind of all that's this is about? Because if it's something he did himself, could he not just reverse it himself? I don't know. Is this is something? Maybe this is something that is or could be working through the handbook machinery right now. Maybe it's just something top down, and he's throwing himself in front of the upset that members are feeling. I don't know why he said that he's at his core is all about loving, serving, and supporting the 12 and the first presidency, and he can't go against them as the end to an answer to a question which he said was all his doing. Like I don't understand that. So I do believe Elder Bragg, and I believe him when he said that he was telling the full story honestly, but I don't quite believe that it was the full story because it doesn't make sense to me. And there are a couple other things that I have learned since we last spoke, Aaron, which I are confidential sources, which I can't reveal, but really make me think that it is coming from higher up in the church. But ultimately, this gets down to what we were just talking about, like who has the power and the authority to change things, and how is that connected to priesthood, and how much can a ward do versus how much has to be church level? Obviously, no ward will ever call a woman bishop without significant legislative change from the church. But there are a lot of other questions that are kind of open, and I really appreciated that Elder Bragg answered the question, but I actually don't feel any more clarity. I feel like he sort of underlined all the questions I already have. I don't know. Having heard the story,
Yeah.
what do you think? Because I don't think you were at that meeting, if I'm not
No,
correct.
I was not. Look, I'm an active member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, except for a state conference, adult sessions.
They're the best sessions, but I get it. I get it.
No, actually, the thing that I caught from that story was that to me, this is the first statement that I've heard about advocacy leading to change in the handbook.
Yeah, that's a good point and relevant to this season so far.
I think that's really interesting, right? And
Yeah.
it makes me want to write a letter.
It's almost encouraging you to.
To be honest, it makes me feel less nervous about making a podcast
Well, good.
about a
Yeah.
third rail subject.
This can be your introduction to our new state president when he gets your letter. Oh, here's another related story, real quick, just a quick aside. A sister in
Yeah.
our ward whose husband was a bishop in another stake in the past, said that he was notoriously liberal. I don't know if you've met any liberal Mormons, Aaron, but a notorious liberal in this ward, in a place where people aren't liberal. And members were sending letters to Salt Lake constantly complaining about his politics. And they would all get sent back to the stake president who would show them to him. So
That's
everybody keep that in mind.
really
Anyway,
funny.
you were going to say something.
Well, okay, so that's my first observation, is that isn't it interesting that advocacy could work in that way, right? But my other observation is, yeah, why was okay, was a question. He really said he felt like hurt by the reaction.
No, he didn't feel hurt. He felt bad that other people felt hurt. He didn't anticipate it. He was caught totally off guard. He regretted the pain that was caused. Yeah, he felt really bad that it had gone so poorly and that it hurt people. And I'd like to point out that I think this is reasonable, right? He's seen 70 people on state conference, like, why is everybody up here? What is this all about? He's not attending sacrament meetings, but
Yeah.
again, I would hope that he was more aware of why it was happening and the good of it, but maybe not, right? I mean, one thing about leaders is they kind of only know what they get to see and what they're shown. It's sort of like Chairman Mao. I hate to compare someone to Chairman Mao, but it's kind of like Chairman Mao going through China during the Great Leap Forward and wanting to see the steel and seeing all the great bars of steel that people have mined, and then he doesn't know that they had to melt down all their tools in order to impress him, and now they're going to starve to death.
Oh boy.
And that's a risky thing about being a leader, right? You kind of, if you run the risk, and this is why hierarchies are problematic, and this is why DNC section 121 is really important. Even if you're a really good person doing the right thing for the right reasons, hierarchies make it easy to engage in unrighteous dominion totally by accident, with the best intentions. And so I think it's really important that we think about this as a people.
Yeah, hierarchy is one of the most interesting topics of this conversation, right? Fiona Givens examines the usage of the word advancement in the priesthood, right? How it's called priesthood advancement. You move from teacher to priest. That's an advancement, right?
Yeah, which
and
is the
if
wrong
it
way
is,
to think about it.
No, no, no.
Oh, maybe I'm wrong. Okay, sure, go ahead.
No, no, I'm saying maybe you are, maybe you're not. But all I'm saying is that word has come on, give me a fancy English word.
It suggests that you're better than what you used to be.
No, that's not what I'm trying to say.
Oh, that's not what you're trying to say.
A cognitive weight, right? It has
it has connotations that change the way we feel about stuff.
Yeah, that's right. It has a semantic meaning. It colors the way we look at the priesthood, right? And it reinforces the concept of hierarchy and the concept of superiority, right? That language, right? And you'll find this language throughout discussions of the priesthood and how it's organized, right? That isn't to say that quorums are bad and that moving from deacon to priest to teacher in such a way as to teach a young boy new authorities and new responsibilities as they get older isn't a bad thing, right? But women don't get to advance that way.
Not as officially, yeah. And not with the expectation that there is actual meaning to it. Changing from a beehive to a Maya maid to a laurel, maybe
I was
advancement,
gonna say,
but
a young women president is going to be very mad at me when I said that, right?
Yeah, well, because they do call it advancement. They literally call it advancement. That's what they call it. And I suppose with all the goals and everything, there is the idea that you're growing, and hopefully you are, right? Like, but you're right. Like, advancement carries a weight that maybe is inappropriate for this discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't been in a kid for a while at this point. So it's possible that they're restructuring. It's possible that the restructuring of the young women's and the young men's programs to be this goal-oriented kind of unified path has greatly changed how youth feel about these issues, right? Maybe they feel more supported.
That's interesting. I'm skeptical, but
yeah, I am.
But I wonder
I am too,
if that's
because,
the goal.
But they're not dumb. I'm. They can. They still look up at the stand and they see a dude up there.
Yeah. Yeah. They're gonna. Yeah. Kids are gonna see stuff.
Yeah. So I'm not really sure. Of course. Okay. Like I said, today I'm trying to explore a topic. So maybe I should have made that more clear at the front.
Yeah, I thought we were doing something different, but that's okay.
Well, okay, where did you think we were going to go today? Maybe we could call this
exactly,
the first half of this episode.
But I thought it would be more obviously sequel-y to the first one, as opposed as like this is part one, this is part two. But really what it was, the sequence was actually not, say, chronological or linear. It was inward and outward. It was an example, and now we're sort of talking about the concepts and how they might impact a number of different things. I think that's a fair thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas last time we focused on definitions, today I wanted to focus more about feelings and about.
Actually, I want to take back what I said. I was referring more to like the On the Stand episode. That's where we were really precise. And you're right. Last time was definitions. This time, the way people feel about stuff and the way people act because of feelings. And there's no way around that. People going to act because of their feelings.
Yeah.
That's why we have bodies, maybe. And so we have this option for acting.
So what have we said today? What have been our themes?
Wow, we've been kind of all over the place, haven't we? How did you start it? What was the first thing?
Credit.
Credit, right. So we talked about credit, and we talked about authority, the danger of hierarchies, how all these things are intersected, whether we like it or not, how there may be room, in fact, in the church to do something about it, and the children of the future.
Can I just say one thing, though, about credit?
Sure.
I'm not saying that I want credit in the church. I'm not saying that women want credit in the church. What I am saying is that people like to be validated, right? And what I am saying is that, well, okay, that's all I'm trying to say, is that it's nice to feel like you belong. It's nice to feel like you can affect the way things are going, right? I mean, I'm not in a leadership position right now. In fact, I really haven't ever been in a leadership position in the church. I've always been in supporting positions, right? And it's fine for me. I'm quite happy with that.
Yeah.
If I live my whole life being only in supportive positions, that's just totally fine with me, right? And, you know, if maybe enough stake presidents people listen to this podcast, maybe that's the only hope that I'll ever have. But my point is that at least, how can I say this? I don't want any more advancement. I don't want to be a bishop. I don't want to be a stake president. I don't want to be a high council member, right? But I would never turn those things down either. There's this fundamental feeling that Mormons have about service in the church that I think that if you're not a member of the church, it's really hard to describe. And that feeling is, I don't want to, but I will if asked. And if somebody else is a leader, a great deal of respect for that person, right?
See, I think you're a better person than me. I think it would be more accurate for me if I said, I don't want that.
Yeah.
Like, it's something I kind of have to struggle against because I know all the downsides. Like, I don't particularly want a position that's going to keep me super busy. Like, I get the cost. But, you know, when you're bishop, the rest of your life, as long as you live in that ward, people will call you bishop and they'll remember that you serve the ward in that position. There aren't very many callings like that. There aren't very many things where the echoes and the ripples last for so long in terms of people making you feel good about the service you did.
Which isn't the reason to do it.
No, absolutely not. And I don't think anybody seeks after or wants the calling necessarily. Probably some people do. There's a lot of variety of people in the world, but I don't think that's a big motivation for people. But it is a side effect, and it is a hard thing to, I mean, we can't just ignore it. It's a real thing. And that's going to affect the way people feel about the position and how much people kind of sort of do or do not want it, because there's just no way around it.
It's such a hard needle to thread, this conversation. But yeah, as of right now, there's a whole gender that will never have that kind of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we feel about that? If we don't say that out loud, right?
Yeah.
If we left that unsaid, I guarantee you there are people that are feeling it in their hearts.
The lie of omission.
I mean, I think it's really easy to come back to me and said, look, you doofus, read the scriptures again. No, the priesthood is about service. You shouldn't be thinking these kind of thoughts.
Well, I think there's a real difference between thinking these thoughts about me, myself, and my glorious personage, and thinking these thoughts about the human family and the body of Christ. Those are very different things to think about. No one should spend their life scheming to be an apostle, but we need 12 people to be apostles. And those people are going to give up a lot when they accept that call. And we should definitely appreciate that. And the fact that any limitation on that, whether they're real, like women can't do it, or perceived, like you need a law or a business degree, people are going to notice that. And they're going to feel a way about it, whether they want to or not. And they may feel like they have to repent to that. But as we spoke about, I forget which episode it was, like something should not be the worry of the body of the church. It's somebody higher up's responsibility to worry about that. Which episode was that?
I don't know. I think maybe two episodes ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it might have been. It was the advocacy episode, I guess. So that would have been the stand episode.
Yeah.
And I think that was a really wise thing you said, Aaron. There are some things that we as the members that really shouldn't be our worry. But that doesn't mean it's going to be impossible for us to worry about it anyway. Or not impossible for anyway. That was too many negatives in that sentence. But you know what I mean.
Well, I'm not convinced that I said anything coherent in this episode.
Well, you always get to listen to it first, so
yeah. but if you want to talk about this, what's a specific question we could ask our Discordians on this topic?
Where are we going wrong? I think might be a good one. That's not very specific.
Yeah,
but
are you talking about you and me?
I mean, you and me. Yeah. Because I think the vibe on this particular podcast is we're like reaching out in the dark, looking for something to hold on to. And we're not entirely sure what we're grabbing onto. Is this the iron rod, or is this a slippery pool rod that goes down into the river? It's hard to tell.
Yeah. It's a great question. So, you know, you know, get on the chat, talk to us, tell us what you think, you know, and that's it. I have to say that
yeah,
even if I sound worried and like I'm having a ton of fun with this topic, right? Fun is the wrong word. I am enjoying the intellectual activity of working through this religious discourse.
Yeah, and I do feel that as Latter-day Saints, that's our responsibility.
I'm sad, of course, about the consequences of it, but I'm allowed to feel two things.
Absolutely.
All right, Eric.
Well, Aaron, do you want to be cheered up? I have a suggestion.
Yeah. Okay.
This is not this. The podcast I'm about to recommend is not a member of the Dialogue Pod. What is it called?
The Dialogue Podcast Network.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I wanted to say family really badly, but it's network. The Dialogue Podcast Network, which we are a member of, and you should check out theirs also. But the podcast Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree recently did an episode on Indiana Jones, rather persuasively proving that he's probably a lapsed Mormon. So it's an enjoyable episode, and I recommend it. It'll cheer you up.
All right. Fabulous. Our music's by Daniel Foster Smith. You can follow us on Twitter. And that's it, I guess.
Such a strong ending. Look at this go.
Do you have a better ending?
No. Let's just taper off into infinity and let the music come up and let us be lost in our thoughts.
This is like The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, you know, right. Did you ever watch Craig Ferguson's talk show?
Uh-huh.
Something he would often do at the end of episodes, who give, I forget what the other option was, but one of the options that he would offer his guests on this show is a moment of awkward silence, and then they would just sit there and be awkward on live television. And, yeah.
All right, bye.
All right, bye.